As I'm sure you know, dear listeners, Rio de Janeiro boasts the world's biggest Jesus, this giant concrete Christ with his arms outstretched. But the Redeemer hasn't been going so well lately. Let me read you an intro to a new book we're about to discuss about Brazil. We are the number one champion in homicidal violence. One in every 10 people killed around the world is Brazilian. Most of them are young black boys dying by guns. Brazil is also one of the world's largest consumers of drugs, and around 50% of homicides on the streets of Brazil are related to the war on drugs. Now, Rio is known by its inhabitants as the marvellous city, and it deserves that. It's flamboyant, it's blessed with that spectacular climate and topography, steep mountains encrusted with favelas, the slums, and there's the Atlantic Ocean, this vast bay and the famous beaches where all the elements of the population converge. But, of course, the cocaine trade, gun violence, palpable social tension, divisions between the glamorous, the glitzy down below, and the very poor that crust the cliffs. This is Rio, where a pacification program is attempting to make it worthy of the global spotlight. And this is the setting for the latest book from our next guest, Misha Glenning. His previous investigations have focused on the global mafia and the internet underworld, and now he has trained his investigative eye on the violent underbelly. I don't know that underbelly is quite the word. It's almost the overbelly there of Rio de Janeiro. The book is called Nemesis, One Man and the Battle for Rio. And Glennie joins us from a hectic European book tour to tell us about this Brazilian city and its criminal intrigues. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Philip. It's nice to be with you.
Is there any city more fascinating than Rio? Of course, right at the moment, it's between two immense sporting events.
It is, and it is a fascinating place, but it is a place that is also subject to many stereotypes in the way that we perceive it. I mean, when most people think of Rio, they actually think of Copacabana Beach and the song The Girl from Ipanema, beautiful people, a party atmosphere, and it is all of these things, there's no doubt about it. But of course, Rio has its dark side as well, and it is a city that is divided quite spectacularly between the very rich and the very poor. And the strange thing about Rio, and the very poor, of course, live in the slums or the favelas, that unlike everywhere else in Brazil, where the poor people tend to live on the periphery of cities, because of that topography of the city that you mentioned with all of its hills and lagoons, in some of the richest areas, you have slums situated right in the middle. And when cocaine started to flow into the country, because Brazil became the main transit route for cocaine going from Colombia to the European market, and it developed its own retail market inside the country, then the favelas became the place where the coke was distributed from to the rich areas. And very soon, they were making so much money out of cocaine that the gangs inside the favelas, which were no-go areas for the police, started to arm themselves very heavily. And that led to an extremely bloody decade in the 1990s.
Now, when I was last in Brazil, the favelas were well established, but there's many, many more now. How many are there if you add them all up?
In Rio de Janeiro, there are about 1,000 favelas. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Not all of them, of course, are in the center. Most now stretch out to the north and the west of the city. And the people living in the favelas, of course, tend to work in the center. And often, those in the north and the west have to travel literally 3.5 hours, 4 hours from their homes in the favelas to the places they work in the city, both there and back every day. So there are lots of favelas, but the one that I concentrate on in the book is called Rocinha, or Rocinha in Brazilian Portuguese, and it is the biggest favela, the biggest slum, not just in Rio, not just in Brazil, but reputedly in all of South America. Some 120,000 people packed into an area the size of a medium village, and surrounded by three of the wealthiest areas in Rio de Janeiro. And so it is a most peculiar existence for the people who live there, and of course for the people who live around it.
Before we get into the cocaine story, it has to be said that there's a rich cultural and social life in the favelas. It's where they spend so much of the year preparing for those spectacular parades through the city. They're not the grimmest of slums by any means.
No, some of the ones in the north and the west are the grimmest of slums, but the ones like Rocinha in the center are, first of all, extremely energetic economic entities. There are people running around busy as bees all the time, with shops, with restaurants, with these fantastic little moto taxis, which is basically little motorbikes, which is the main form of transport, because the point about the favelas in Rio is most of them are built up hills. And so it's quite a pain going up and down them all the time. So you go up on these motorcycles. They're very vibrant places. And indeed, Rocinha became, during the first decade of this century, became an extremely fashionable place to go, in large part because of the activity of the man who ran the favela, who was called Nem of Rocinha. And that's the focus of the book, of how he turned this place not just into a place where poor people gathered and lived, but where actually people from outside wanted to visit because it was such a funky happening place. And of course, you could buy a lot of cocaine there.
And as I mentioned earlier, we're rushing towards the Olympics, which take place in Brazil, what, in August next year?
That's right. So that you mentioned earlier on this policy called pacification. And although pacification wasn't begun because of the Olympics and the World Cup, which has also been very soon, pacification became extremely important in convincing the world that Rio would be able to host the Olympics successfully. And what pacification was, it was begun at the beginning of 2007, was the incoming government, and particularly the Secretary of State for Security in Rio province, decided that after 50 years of neglect, the state had to do something about the favelas. Apart from anything, the levels of violence and homicide, as we were, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, the levels of violence were and the levels of weaponry inside the favelas were simply unsustainable. It was an appalling situation. So the minister decided that he would send in special forces to try and flush out the drug gangs. He knew he wasn't going to stop the cocaine trade, but he wanted to get rid of some of the weapons. And then, as a quid pro quo for sending in the heavy mob, because Brazilian police are not the kind of people you want to meet on a street late at night, believe you me, the idea was to send in something called social pacification, which was the creation of creches, schools, health centers, all the things that the favelas lacked, although this hasn't really happened. But you have now got favelas pacified in most of the main tourist areas and down at the centres in anticipation of the Olympics.
Can we walk the story back? Because we're rushing through it, and it's so complex and so extraordinary. Let's go back to, the star of the book, and that's Nem. You're drawn to the city and the story by his arrest in 2011. But he wasn't just some ordinary thug. In many ways, he was a social progressive. He was a drug lord philanthropist.
Yes. Well, Nem, or Antonio, which is his real name, had a very peculiar introduction into the drugs trade. He was not involved in drugs at all until his mid-20s, by which time most drug lords in Rio are either dead or retired. And he only became involved because his 10-month-old daughter at the time developed a very rare autoimmune disease called Langerhans cell histiocytosis. And the only way he could treat his daughter was to borrow a lot of money, because the health costs were prohibitively high for him on his modest salary for his legitimate job in town. And the only person, because he was a slum dweller, who was in a position to lend him that money was the then boss of the favela, of the drugs trade, who lent him the equivalent of about $10,000. And the only way he could pay it back was to become involved in the drugs trade himself as one of the boss's minions. He was naturally very, very intelligent. And in the space of about 4 years, he also had an entrepreneurial side to him. He was king of the hill, as it were. He'd taken over after his boss was assassinated by the police. He became the new boss. And as you say, he was something of a social philanthropist. If you run the drugs trade in a favela, you can either rely on violence basically intimidate people into supporting your operation, or you can try and get a consensus in the favela amongst its residents by giving them some of the benefits of the drug trade. And so what Antonio did is he realized that if you lower the level of violence, take the guns off the street, you still have them, you still control the place because you have a monopoly on violence, but if you lower the tension, then business turnover increases. And he was able to channel some of the profits back into a sort of welfare state that he created, which is why it became so popular.
It's often described as a lawless city, but you're making it quite clear that there were laws, and they were imposed to some extent by the drug elite.
Yes. The laws depend on where you are, which slum you're in, which part of the town you're in, which police force you happen to be, particular district of the police happen to be in. It's very bitty. But in the favelas themselves, because there was no state presence except for the occasional raid by police forces who were often very corrupt, then these informal structures of policing organized and implemented by the drug gangs became the way of life. And to an extent, they still are the way of life in many of the favelas of Rio.
It must be said that a few decades ago, there were death squads who'd go around, often associated with the police force, just simply killing people. So you're describing a much more ordered and, in a sense, tranquil society.
No, please don't mistake this for a tranquil and ordered society, because it's not. In the 1990s and the early 2000s, Rio was a hellhole. It was a hellhole because the police were out of control, as you say, with their death squads, killing people in favelas, killing street children. The drug gangs, which in Rio, again, uniquely in Rio, there are three main drug gangs, always fighting amongst themselves in very bloody turf wars, sometimes turning into big shootouts with the police. This was anything but ordered. But what you saw
was a joke, Michel.
Yeah, right. I know. I just don't want you to give the impression that I've written a sort of counterintuitive narrative about a city that is actually wonderful when it suffers from very, very severe problems of security, stability, and wealth inequality, because it really is tough. But it got better in the first decade of this century. I have to stress that it has improved.
Now, you met Nem on a number of occasions in the Slammer. How do these things coexist in the man, this genius for balancing violence with philanthropy?
It's fascinating, because I wrote to him in prison after he'd been arrested, and I said, look, this is who I am, and I'd like to come see you and write about your story. And to my great surprise, he wrote back very quickly and said, you're welcome to come and talk to me, and we'll see if there's any room for cooperation on a book. I ended up seeing him 10 times for a total of 28 hours, and it was really strange, because it's a maximum security prison right in the middle of the Brazilian interior near the Bolivian border. So it's a long time getting there. It's very bureaucratic to get there. And because it's a maximum security prison, unlike most Brazilian prisons, it's very efficient, all biometric identification. And I would walk into a room, and there was this guy, seeing him for the first time. He's quite tall, very charismatic, eyes staring into you the whole time. His gaze never shifts from you, but he's shackled to a steel table, and he's handcuffed. And you develop a relationship which is simultaneously very intimate because he's telling you about his whole life, and very distant because it's such a peculiar circumstances. And I was never able to do anything like shake his hand. And what struck me when I was talking to him was that he knew that he had used violence. He knew that he had done wrong things. But he clearly struggled with each decision in terms of whether it was morally the right thing to do, whether it was organizationally the right thing to do, and whether it was practically the right thing to do. So he was a man who thought very deeply, I felt, because of the fact that he wasn't just head of the drugs cartel. He was effectively prime minister of a community of 120,000 people. And actually, he was making decisions that a CEO of a big, complex corporation would have to make.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me ask you this. Has any significant political figure emerged from the favelas? With his, with his capacities, he might, in fact, have had a conventional political career.
Well, I think that what he would have had was a conventional business career rather than a political career, because he was a very good businessman. Very few people have emerged from the favelas as major players inside Brazil. Almost all of them, there are one or two, but almost all of them come from the relatively privileged middle class in the first place. These are two worlds. When you enter into a favela like Rocinha, which is literally 15 yards away from some of the wealthiest apartments in Rio, into a world of incredible squalor, you realize that they are living, although they are connected geographically and in terms that one area sells cocaine and also provides all the maids and gardeners and drivers for the middle class, you are entering into almost a parallel world, a different planet. And so you can see how difficult it is to get out of the poverty of the favelas and into any position of influence of Brazil.
Your story, let's walk it back again. Your story begins with an extraordinarily vivid scene, which I'll describe in a second to the listener. But at the time, he's trying to get out of the business and indeed out of the favela. And his arrest begins your narrative, a floodlight, live-to-air media spectacular in which Nem is dragged, bewildered from the boot of a car by competing police forces in the car park of Rio's Naval Club. Heavens above, what does he tell you about the lead-up to that moment?
Oh, well, this was really, in a way, this was the sub-narrative of the 10 meetings I had with him. I started off by asking him, first of all, I said, what was going on that evening of November the 9th, November the 10th, 2013, when you were arrested? And that was the first, interview I was seeing him. And he said, we're going to need, for you to understand, for you to have even the slightest idea of what was going on, we're going to need a lot more time than we have today. Because in that first interview, we were sort of introducing ourselves, and I only had a couple of hours on that first one. And really, over the next 9 meetings, I slowly began to unravel what was happening there. Because, as you pointed out, and this is very important, is the stress of everything on them became too much. And about over a year before he was actually arrested, he started entering into intensive clandestine negotiations with the authorities in Rio to give himself up and to find some way of reducing the tension that he felt was building in the city, and specifically in Rocinha. And you know, in that last year, I could now tell, having interviewed him at length, that he was finding everything far too much and he just wanted out. The problem is that once you're in a situation like that, extracting yourself from the drugs business is actually very, very hard because your life is always on the line.
Let's now introduce or name a character you've mentioned in passing, the character of Beltrame, the Secretary of Security in the Rio State. And he's a sympathetic character, according to you. He's been the driving force behind this euphemistically described pacification program.
Yes. And the reason why, I mean, I've got to know Beltrame, who is actually Nem's nemesis, his real-life nemesis. I've got to know him quite well over the past 3 years, and I've interviewed him a number of times. And what struck me that, first of all, when I had my first interview with him, he said, look, I'm going to be frank with you. For the last 50 years, this country, this state, has neglected the favelas. We have allowed the favelas to stew in their own juices of poverty, and it's an absolute disgrace. And he said, we have to give something back to the favelas. So that, for me, was a very different tone from the way that Brazilian security personnel have traditionally viewed the favelas, which is to see them as just sort of dens of iniquity.
Well, it's a big advance on death squads, that's for sure.
It's a big advance on death squads, Philip, absolutely so. And so he, you know, he said, look, I'm Secretary of State for Security. I have to start with the security issue and reducing the number of guns in the favela and put the police in. But I need the help of all of my colleagues, because if we don't give something back to the favelas, pacification will not work. And unfortunately, I know that that Beltrame now thinks that this is the situation he's in. He's done his bit, but not enough money has gone into the favelas. And as we approach the Olympics, he is concerned about his pacification policy, because of the fact that the drugs and the violence are slowly coming back to the favelas just at the time when Rio is going to be in the huge spotlight, global spotlight, because of the Olympic Games.
I remember vividly the depth and breadth of corruption to get out of the city's airport. I remember I had to bribe the airline officials, you know, to get on the damn plane. And clearly a huge number of the cops would be corrupted by the cocaine trade. This must make Beltrame's job all the more, well, impossible.
Oh, it's really difficult. He actually identifies as, along with corruption, is the biggest problem, the rivalry between the two main police forces responsible for law enforcement in Rio. That is the so-called civil police, which is responsible for investigating crimes, and the military police, which is actually a civilian police force in theory, which is responsible for operational policing on the streets on a day-to-day basis. And these two police forces hate each other. I mean, they really hate each other, and they spend their entire time trying to undermine each other, from the commissioners at the top down to cops on the beat. And this makes policing of Rio incredibly difficult, and also creates opportunities for people involved in drugs, involved in burglary, involved in mugging, and so on, to carry out their activities. So I feel that Beltrame has made a very good fist of things with extremely limited resources and facing immense challenges. Whether he will go down as a success in history or a failure in Rio, I don't know. But he's certainly tried hard.
John Campner of The Observer says of you, Mishap, that you don't just write books, you live them. After these years in Rocinha, any changes to your personality?
No, I'm just exhausted, as you pointed out, Philip, at the beginning. So, you know, I'll confess now, you can't see it. I'm sure you'd be shocked if you saw me. But I'm now in my late 50s. And in order to do this book, I felt I had to go and live in the favela. I had to experience what it was like living in this the depth of poverty and squalor, and how these people manage to create actually very meaningful lives in these very difficult circumstances. I also had to teach myself Portuguese, which, although on paper Portuguese is quite easy, the Portuguese that they speak in Rocinha is incredibly difficult, and that was a strain, again, in my late 50s.
I think you should come to Australia for your next book. We more or less speak English, and you'd be much safer.
That's perfectly true, because if you wander around the favelas, you come across, you know, 21, 19-year-old kids with large semi-automatic weapons, and it's like, you know, when you see a 220-pound gorilla, what do you call it? Basically, you call it whatever it wants you to call it, because you're very scared. But fortunately, everyone saw that I was a dumb foreigner, and no one was going to take me out just for being there. So it was okay. But the whole experience has, I confess, been very stressful. But I think, you know, worthwhile, and I'm very pleased with the way that I've been allowed to understand this culture and to explain a lot about Brazil and Rio that people normally won't be able to access through the extraordinary story of this one guy.
Not that I'm terribly interested in sport, but are they ready for the Olympics?
Well, I mean, my own feeling is no, although the Brazilians have a history of snatching victory from the jaws of defeat when it comes to organizing big events. And they do, of course, organize Carnival in Rio every year. They very recently had a very successful visit of the new Pope. The Pope Francis's first visit abroad was to Rio, and it went off very, very well. However, I have to warn that, although it's not often realized outside of Brazil, Brazil is at the moment in the throes of a monumental political, economic, and constitutional crisis. And cuts are being made to budgets left, right, and center, including to the security budget of Rio de Janeiro. And cuts also have been made to the Olympics budget by 30% just in the last 10 days or so. And there is real concern that this is going to be touch and go as to whether they're going to be able to successfully hold these Olympics or not, and whether the security situation is going to be okay, or whether you'll see muggers and gangs on the street again.
No wonder the Pope called in. It'll take him and his prayers and the outstretched arms of that vast concrete Christ to save it. Look, thank you very much, Misha. Misha Glennie, the new is called Nemesis, One Man, and the Battle for Rio. And talking about battles, Angela Merkel is having the battle of her political life, and we'll discuss it on LNL after a little bit of music.